We are headed into summer, and Maine politics are heating up. Last week, Congressman Mike Michaud announced he may be running for governor. And then former House Majority Leader Emily Kane put her hat in the ring for Michaud's seat. The 2014 campaign appears to be underway, and this is all happening at the end of a highly political legislative session, with high-stakes maneuvering on topics such as Medicaid expansion, hospital repayment, and taxes. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk politics with three experts. Mike Cuzzi is former campaign aide to President Obama, Senator Kerry, and Congressman Tom Allen. He manages the Portland office for Vox Global, a strategic communications and public affairs firm headquartered in Washington, D.C. Dan DeMeritt, who is a Republican political consultant and public relations specialist. He is former campaign aide and communications director for Governor Paula Page. And Emily Shaw, assistant professor of political science at Thomas College. We'd like you to join the conversation. Email us at talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Taking the pulse of Maine politics, this is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling on MPBN Radio is made possible in part by Vayu Funeral Home. Pleased to provide green funerals and burials throughout central Maine. More at newenglandgreenfunerals.com.
Welcome to you all, and thanks for being here on Maine Calling. First, I'm going to turn, though, to Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, who is joining us by phone. Fitzgerald is president of Critical Insights, which is a nonpartisan national public opinion polling and market research company based in Portland. Mary Ellen, what do we know at this point about the governor's race and the political parties in Maine? Mary Ellen Fitzgerald. Okay, we'll try to get back to you, and we'll start then with our guests here in the studio today. Emily Shaw, I think a lot of people believe this is a matter of numbers, that if we have a strong three-way governor's race, if it ends up with three strong candidates like it might with Mike Michaud, Elliot Cutler, and Governor LePage, that we're headed to a repeat of the 2010 election. Do you believe that that's a given?
Well, I think we have a really different dynamic in that we now have an incumbent governor. In 2010, it was an open seat, which meant that the dynamic was different. Incumbents are traditionally stronger when they run a second time. On the other hand, we also have a lot of frustration among Democrats, perhaps some leftward-leaning independents who are very frustrated with the current governor. And so that may also change the dynamic substantially from what it was in 2010 when Governor LePage was less well-known.
Mike Cuzzi.
I agree largely with Emily. This is not going to be a repeat of 2010. LePage hadn't been governor for several years in 2010. Mike Michaud is not Libby Mitchell. And Elliot Cutler is not an unknown quantity to most voters anymore. So I think we're going to see a really dynamic, competitive race. Having said that, I do think the echoes of 2010 will be seen in this governor's race. And what I mean by that is I think voters will be cognizant of what happened in 2010 with the vote being split to allow Governor LePage to ascend to office. And I think voters will that the lingering discontent amongst Democrats and independents with LePage is so significant that voters will enter September of 2014 looking for the candidate that can beat Governor LePage. And if that's Elliot, I think they'll go there. And if that's Mike Michaud, I think they will go there. And so the race will be who can be the one to beat Elliot, to beat Paul LePage in September of 2014.
All right. And Dan DeMeritt, I would like to let you weigh in on this question, especially because you have such an interesting perspective on it.
Sure. In 2010, I went swimming this weekend and it got me down.
In the ocean?
In the lake, and the pollen was about 2 inches deep. You had to cut through it before you could swim.
Oh, my.
In 2010, Elliot Cutler came on really strong in the end. And I think the big question will be if it's a three-way race with three strong, well-financed candidates, which is what it is shaping up to be, can Elliot Cutler, hold on to those voters that moved to him in the end because he seemed like to be the more viable alternative to candidate Paula Page. I think those same voters, I don't think those are his voters necessarily. I think they're voters that are going to move to, who, as Mike talked about, whoever is seen as the more viable candidate. But I do think 2014 shapes up a lot like 2010 in that it's just simple math, and Paula Page is will never go below 35.
You're talking 35% of the voters,
yeah. Vote. And I think, you know, his supporters are very strong, They're committed. They're going to get out. It's an off-year election. It's not a presidential year, so turnout will be lower. And I think that he's got a real good shot to be well above 40. So if that's the case, then either Cutler or Mischu would have to, one of them would have to completely collapse for the other to have a chance to catch LePage.
Interesting. Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, are you there now? Mary Ellen, can you hear us? Okay, we'll go back to the rest of our conversation. Mike Cuzzi, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is a real effort to try and make this not a three-way race. And what I mean by that is I think in particular we will see outside interest, probably the Democratic Governors Association, come out pretty strong to try and take out Elliott. As early as possible to make him a less than credible or less than attractive candidate so that it really becomes a de facto two-person race. And in that circumstance, Mike Mischu is the beneficiary of Cutler's law support.
Go ahead, Emily Shaw.
Yeah, and I think that because of that effort, I think that interestingly enough, Cumberland County is going to be the locus of a lot of the hottest campaigning, which is unusual because usually Cumberland County is kind of wrapped up. But I think that's where, you know, a lot of the action is going to be in this race.
And that kind of goes against some of the, traditional wisdom about Maine politics is that races are decided in the second district. So not just the second district, but Cumberland County in the first district.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, Portland will be a big, Elliot's from Cape Elizabeth, Elliot Cutler's from Cape Elizabeth, and he'll have a strong power base here. And he's well known here and respected here. So it'll be a question of whether, Mike Mischu, who is very well liked in his district and is a good congressman and is a good man, whether he can make the kind of inroads he needs to make in southern Maine to knock Cutler down into the teens, which is essentially where he needs to be to assure Mischu has a real shot at outpacing LePage.
What does Mischu's announcement that he's forming an exploratory committee mean for John Baldacci? Mike Cuzzi.
I think former Governor Baldacci has been pretty clear that should either Congresswoman Pingree or Congressman Mischu run, obviously Congresswoman Pingree has said she's not, and now that Mike is in, he's made very clear that he is not going to pursue the office. So I think he has deferred. And whether or not he pursues anything else, if there's any other electoral office in his future, I guess is to be determined. But he's certainly not running for governor.
All right. Well, we're going to try one more time. Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, can you hear us? Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, can you hear us? I'm so sorry. Hopefully we'll be able to get to her at some point during this program. Let me try one more time. Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, are you there? I apologize for this. Let's talk about the legislature a little bit. The governor has vetoed the plan to expand Medicaid in Maine. The original vote in the legislature was just a couple votes short of the two-thirds needed to override a veto. How do political considerations play into this issue? What's the political calculation some Republican state legislators are making when deciding whether to sustain the veto or perhaps stick with their original vote? Dan DeMeritt.
I think what they look at is the budget that's just worked its way through the legislature as well, and the incredible burden that Medicaid places on the Appropriations Committee, on spending decisions we have in Maine, and how it crowds out other decisions, and how we, in many respects, don't have a lot of control over what we can do in terms of once we commit to extending coverage to certain segments of the population, it seems like we get locked in and it ties our hands. And I think a lot of Republicans saw that with the budget that was just passed, and I think they'll vote to sustain the governor's veto.
Do you all agree with that?
Well, I think the political consideration for Republicans is whether or not they can go back into their district and make a credible case for why they denied expanding health care coverage to 70,000 working poor here in the state of Maine, and also refused to expand that coverage when there's no fiscal note attached to it. In fact, the expectation based on studies that have been conducted is that Maine could stand to save $700 million, save the state treasury $700 million by participating in Medicaid expansion. So I think they have to weigh whether or not they can go back to their districts and make an argument for denying coverage to 70,000 working poor in the state.
Emily Shaw, what about the political calculations they're making? Are people, are the voters, is the voting public following this issue closely enough for it to have an impact in the 2014 race?
Well, you know, in addition to thinking about that, we have to think about the dynamics that have been established over time of, you know, the veto override votes. The Maine Senate has never so far this session voted to override the governor's veto, and they've frequently switched. Republican senators and Republican representatives have frequently switched their votes in order to sustain the governor's veto. So I think that there's a dynamic where they see that there's going to be a benefit to doing that. And so, you know, understanding that this is not a unanimous issue, that Medicaid expansion is not a unanimous issue, makes it less likely, I think, that they would then go ahead and switch that vote under these circumstances.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking politics in Maine right now, looking at what's going on. Mike Cuzzi, it looked like you wanted to jump in just then.
Yeah, one of the things that I think we've seen so far in this legislative session is that Republicans have shown good faith to the governor and chosen to sustain his vetoes on issues that, frankly, were relatively small. We're at a point in the session where we're down to brass tacks. It's Medicaid expansion. It's the budget. And now is the time that I think a lot of Republicans have to vote their conscience as opposed to voting in lockstep with the governor. And frankly, we're at a point where really, the ability to govern rests primarily with Republican legislators who can decide they want to stick with the governor and potentially send the state into a shutdown, or who can decide they want to pragmatically govern and work with the Democrats to do the people's business.
Well, Mike Cuzzi, you mentioned the budget. And so that, unlike the Medicaid expansion, has originally passed with what seems like a veto-proof majority. But, of course, we never know. It depends who's present on the day of the vote and who switches a vote. Dan DeMeritt, do you have any thoughts about the state budget, where it's headed, and what Republican lawmakers are thinking about right now?
I don't think the governor can support it as it's written, but I don't know that that's necessarily his job right now. I mean, the governor is in a position where he's trying to push Maine in a certain direction, and he proposed a budget that, you know, given the fiscal realities, was what he could live with. The legislature, after hearing from, you know, after taking months to hear from people, came to a different spot. And I think the governor is going to continue to push and advocate for a direction that he sees as being in the best interest of Maine. And I think that, you know, I don't think he can support it, whether that means he vetoes it or doesn't offer a signature or comes back with some line item vetoes. I don't think he can support it, but I think the legislature ends up enacting it without his support and keeps Maine open for business.
So we're not, in your view, Dan DeMeritt, we're not looking at a government shutdown this year.
I don't think so. There's a lot of Republicans in the Augusta area, Senator Flood, Senator Cates, some House members in that region who have a lot of state employees who work in their districts. They're going to be working really hard to keep those people going to work and avoid a shutdown. I just don't think. I don't think there's a unifying issue like we had in 1991 with the workers' comp reform that can, you know, that can lead to a coalition that would block the budget from going forward.
All right. Emily Shaw.
Yeah, really the biggest issue in this budget is the question of municipal revenue sharing. And that's a very different question than the workers' comp issue from 1991, because there we're talking about a measure of property tax relief, really. I mean, municipal revenue sharing was enacted in order to counteract the effects of property tax. So this is something that hits a lot of pocketbooks as opposed to a relatively more limited number.
I agree on revenue sharing being the big issue. And I agree. I also think that perhaps the governor has lost some opportunities to convince people that revenue sharing is not necessarily directly tied to property tax changes and provide some more leadership using his bully pulpit and his experience as a mayor. There are some of us, and we are admittedly not the majority, who believe that there's a lot more savings to be had at the at the local level of governing through consolidation and wholesale change. But I also would agree that it's not something you can do in just one budget cycle.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to take your comments and questions. We'll also try to see if we can get Mary Ellen Fitzgerald to join us. This is Maine Calling.
People in Germany are pretty upset by the NSA's data surveillance program, but it's happened before. The NSA kept a listening post there during the Cold War.
We would transcribe artillery fire missions.
This man monitored East German radio traffic 50 years ago.
We didn't care what they were saying. What we cared about was who was saying it and where were they saying it from.
Eavesdropping in Berlin, next time on The World.
Join us for The World this afternoon at 3. The Portland Sea Dogs are generously hosting MPBN at a special Civil War night at their stadium in Portland in partnership with the Pejebscot Historical Society. MPBN members can purchase a specially priced reserve seat for the July 3rd game for just $7. MPBN Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz will be on hand to lead the Sea Dogs Stadium through the 7th inning stretch over the loudspeakers, and MPBN will be showing the 16th Maine at Gettysburg, a new documentary revealing the story of Maine's 16th Volunteer Infantry Regiment on the Jumbotron after the game. For more information and information about tickets for MPBN members, please visit mpbn.net, and we do hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, all about recent political happenings in our state. With me in the studio, Emily Shaw, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Thomas College, Mike Cuzzi, a former campaign aide to President Barack Obama, Senator John Kerry, and Congressman Tom Allen, and Dan DeMeritt, a former campaign aide and communications director for Governor Paul LePage. We would like you to join our conversation. Are you following what's happening in Augusta? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a call now from Becky in Gouldsboro. Becky, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Hi. I have a quick comment and then a question. My comment is, back in the last election up here in Gouldsboro, we're in Hancock County, and we started noticing the switch over to Elliot Cutler amongst friends and people talking at the library and things like that. And it was really hard for, really strong Democrats that have always been a Democrat to feel okay switching over. And so I called down asking for some yard signs because I thought that if they saw that their fellow Democrats were switching to independent and this was okay, that it would really have flipped things around, because I think a lot of people felt like they wish they had voted for him, but they voted early or they didn't feel comfortable abandoning the Democrats. So I just hope that people don't forget us up here in down East Maine, that we aren't the population of Portland, but we have a lot of independent thinkers. And so that's the one comment, is not to forget us up here, that we do matter. And the other thing is, right after the election, I was so frustrated that I called the League of Women Voters, and I asked what was going to be done about tier voting or rank elections, that I never wanted to be stuck in that position again where we, Libby Mitchell was a wonderful candidate, but I wanted to be able to say, this is my first and this is my second. And we ended up getting, someone that was elected by a minority that it didn't really represent like two-thirds of the state. And I'm just wondering where that is now and how long does it take for things like this to really move through and
okay.
get made into law. Thank
Becky,
you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Becky, for your call. And I understand there's a ranked voting bill before the legislature. Emily Shaw, there's not been action on that yet, has there?
Ranked choice voting, there's been a lot of interest this legislature. Several bills have come through that include it. And part of the difficulty is that there's a new machinery that's required for ranked choice voting. So even if the political calculations work out, there's additional logistical issues. And because, you then need more complicated machinery, there's a question of when and where will those those votes be counted. And, you know, there are a number of very small municipalities that are not in line to get anything like that. So, or the expense would be very large. So it's there are logistical issues as well as political issues in place there.
And I think we saw ranked choice voting for, I believe, the first time. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, in the state of Maine, with the election of Mayor Michael Brennan here in Portland. So I think, you know, Portland has sort of been the test case. Probably see that in a few more cycles, I think, before we see any action on a statewide level to move in that direction.
I know some people think, right, I like the idea of ranked choice voting in the sense that I like the idea that the candidate gets elected, one, had to run a 50% campaign to try and, you know, try and be the first or second choice among at least half the electorate. I like that. I like, yeah, and I think Republicans can win by election if we do it right, win by addition if we do it right. But I'm not so sure if we'd had ranked choice voting in 2010, the result may not have been different. I mean, Sean Moody had 5 or 6% of the vote, and there was a strong... He had a strong business message, small business message, and it's likely that Paula Page would have gotten a significant portion of that vote. And then to assume that, you know, the remaining 55%, if LePage couldn't have gotten within the second choice of some of those voters, I think would be a wrong assumption. So,
interesting point, yeah. Dan DeMeritt. We're going to try Mary Ellen Fitzgerald now. Mary Ellen, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you
Yay!
Hear me?
Okay. How exciting.
Finally, it's working.
Yeah, Mary Ellen is president of Critical Insights, which is a nonpartisan national political public opinion polling and market research company. Mary Ellen, what do we know from your point of view about the governor's race at this point?
Well, I think at this point we know what everybody else has alluded to, which is that it's going to be a very spirited election season. Looking at what we know now, here we are, you know, a year and some months before the election, we know that there's a fairly polarized electorate. We did our semi-annual tracking poll in May, and at the beginning of May, what we found was that we asked candidates, if the election were held tomorrow, for whom would you vote? And we came in with about 30% saying, you know, definitively they were going to vote for the governor. Another 28% said Elliot Cutler. 16% said any unnamed Democrat. And I should say that when you hear these numbers, there's a margin of error of plus or minus 4.0. So that 28 and 30% distribution between the governor and Elliot Cutler is really a sort of a statistical dead heat. But what was really interesting to me was the unnamed Democrat, what I think inside baseball players refer to as sort of that yellow dog Democrat vote, which is a solid one in every six, said that they would vote for an unnamed Democrat. 21% said that they didn't know, they really hadn't thought about it. So what we're seeing here is a lot of attention going to be focused on between 20 and 25% of the electorate. And there is going to be a lot of focus, both hands-on campaigning and a lot of media buying. I think this is really going to be a very interesting season. We also know that the political landscape of the state is continuing to change and evolve. About a third of our voters are self-identified Democrats. About 27% are claiming to be Republicans at the point in time that we did this poll in early May. But 35%, really the largest block, are independent. And that says, you know, that says volumes. That says that, you know, over just about a third of all the registered voters in the state really aren't clearly identifying with either political party. I think the stakes are really high at this point in time for the Democrats to try to make a strong showing. And I think that's why sort of the political ramifications of bringing Mike Mishu on are very apparent. They really feel like they need to show, the Democratic Party needs to show, that it's at least relevant in the state. What that's going to do to the race is really anybody's guess, because at this point, looking, you know, and we're even before the primary, but look, just looking at the layout shows you that it's going to be, people are just going to need to pay attention to the arithmetic. That's really, I think, what you're hearing from your panelists as well, that it is going to be a very spirited campaign. You know, you hear the term spoiler thrown in there. I don't think that's a valid term. I think actually, you know, you can sort of apply to anybody who's running against an incumbent as being fighting an uphill battle. But I think this race is anybody's race at this point. It is wide open.
Mary Ellen Fitzgerald, is there a way to measure whether the battles at the State House in Augusta will affect the 2014 election? And if so, how will they?
Well, two separate questions. I mean, there's always a way to measure whether or not people are content or dissatisfied with the performance of their elected officials, and that's at the ballot box, but also in terms of asking them for their opinion and their favorability. And I think there's a certain amount of concern about the wrangling at the State House right now. I think people are seeing a lot of polarization. There's a lot of concern that there may be gridlock or deadlock, that things are not advancing, and that there's not a lot of cooperation. So I think that that's the general sense. But I think we're all talking from inside baseball, as I alluded to earlier. I think the average Maine voter is not paying a lot of attention right now. I think they will start to pay attention in terms of how this plays as we get closer to the election. But I will say this partisan wrangling, I think, that we see at the State House, and the more focus on that we see in the press and in the media, sends a pretty clear message to the voters of Maine that the parties, the traditional parties, can't seem to get it done. And I think that breaks favorability in favor of somebody who's not necessarily affiliated with a party. We'll just have to wait and see how that goes forward. But I think in general that, we didn't ask on this particular wave of the survey about satisfaction with how the legislature is performing. But in previous iterations, certainly last year when we asked this question, we found that people just did not have a lot of favorability or faith that Augusta was going to be able to get out of its own way and actually pass any meaningful budget relief or legislation.
Well, Mary Vellen Fitzgerald, president of Critical Insights, thank you so much for calling in and being so persistent in joining us. We will be watching very closely the results of your polls in the upcoming 17 months. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Mike Cuzzi.
Jennifer, I agree with Mary Ellen that obviously that the more partisan wrangling and bickering that there appears to be oftentimes really turns voters off, might be a benefit to Elliot Cutler. But the one thing that I think has gotten lost in this legislative session because of the high-profile issues such as Medicaid expansion and hospital debt repayment is that there actually has been a lot of bipartisan work going on in the legislature with a divided government. If you look at the budget itself, passed out of Appropriations Committee unanimously, got two-thirds majority in both the House and Senate. The Workforce Committee passed completely bipartisan bill to assist Maine with addressing the skills gap issue. We also saw energy legislation, very significant, meaningful energy legislation, moving out of committee, unanimously receiving bipartisan support in the House and the Senate. Even though some of the more contentious issues have kind of sucked the oxygen out of the room and dominated the reporting, I think it's important to not lose sight of the fact that a lot of good bipartisan work has taken place in this legislature.
And Mike, what you're saying right now is exactly what most legislators will tell you if you spend any time at the State House, is they really are talking a lot about bipartisanship and feeling frustrated that they feel as though the public isn't aware of how much bipartisan work is going on. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dan DeMaird, are we talking about all of this earlier than usual, or does it just feel that way?
No, I think it maybe feels that way. I think it's, pretty typical. It's a big election, and, there are people certainly have strong feelings on the governor, and that's maybe unique in based on his leadership style, his personality, and those that like him an awful lot and think he speaks to them and for them, and those that don't like him have plenty of reason to, so they think, they do, to have issues with him, his leadership style as well. So it's not too early. I mean, people are talking about it, and it'll be on the back burner for a long time, but it'll simmer, and then, it'll heat up, a year from now.
Emily Shaw, I want to follow up on something Dan said a lot earlier, but bringing up the point that this is an off-year election, that 2010 was, of course, a presidential election. This was not a presidential election, but that the governor's race is following in an off-year election. How will that affect it?
Well, traditionally, off-year elections or non-presidential year elections receive a much smaller number of voters. That said, I think that the governor's race is a very exciting race for this state. The governor has been quite polarizing. I think it's fair to say people who love him really love him, and people who don't generally really don't, not just kind of don't. That interest level is likely to drive attendance. I mean, regularly we see non-presidential year elections being larger than usual when there is an issue of interest.
Isn't the conventional wisdom, though, that they favor a more conservative candidate?
Off-year elections?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. I mean, you do get more traditional voters or people who will come out for every election, which tend to be an older electorate, perhaps a more conservative electorate because of that. But on the other hand, it depends a lot on what issues are at stake. So, for instance, in 2009, when you had a ballot measure, you know, not even candidates to elect, that was the same-sex marriage people's veto. Huge, huge turnout, really, for a non-candidate election. So, you know, what's at stake is going to be important in terms of electorate size.
All right. Well, we're going to take another short break when we return. More of your comments and questions. Please stay tuned.
Freedom from the dusty books of philosophers to the tangible realities of politics.
Freedom for me is the ability to do what I like so long as it hurts no one else.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. Evidently not. Many thoughts on freedom, including yours, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us for The Takeaway tonight at midnight. MPBN's Maine Capital Connection television channel offers daily coverage of the legislature in Augusta. Our coverage starts at 10 each weekday morning and includes coverage of House and Senate sessions, select committee hearings, and occasional interviews and press conferences. We also provide a rebroadcast of the day's coverage in the evening, usually at 7 o'clock. The Maine Capital Connection channel is available over the air and on most cable companies' digital tier. For more information, you can visit mpbn.net or call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 800-884-1717.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're talking Maine politics. With me in the studio, Mike Cuzzi, former campaign aide to President Obama, now manages the Portland office for Vox Global, a strategic communications and public affairs firm headquartered in Washington. Dan DeMeritt, Republican political consultant and public relations specialist. He is a former campaign aide and communications director for Governor Paul LePage. And Emily Shaw, assistant professor of political science at Thomas College. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, post to our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling. We'll go now to Robert in Goldsboro. Robert, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. Gee, two of us from the town of little old Goldsboro, Maine. But I had to call when I heard everyone gushing about the bipartisanship in Augusta. I am a Republican, and I have asked my representative and my senator by email many times this session why they vote to pass a bill, and then when the governor vetoes it, they follow the governor and they sustain his veto. I don't call that bipartisanship. I don't know whether it's just a show so they can say, oh, I voted for that. But the fact is that once the governor vetoes it, my two representatives in the legislature, both of them follow the governor blindly. And I'm embarrassed because I, too, am a Republican as they are. If your people would like to comment on this, what I'm trying to say is there ain't much bipartisanship when it comes down to the actual real votes. Thank you.
All right. Dan DeMeritt, I'll let you respond to Robert.
Well, Robert, kudos for paying attention. certainly, it's a level of detail that may get lost on a lot of people. But I think there's a lot of utility for legislators to back up the governor on the Republican side. It's important that the governor's veto carry a lot of weight in negotiations and just the routine management of policy. So I think that's a lot of reason why they'll come around. And once they've heard the governor's point of view, maybe that is something that moves them. But also the ideal that the governor's veto has to carry a lot of weight at the state house, and it's worth I think, to a lot of lawmakers occasionally reversing themselves to support the governor.
Mike.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I said earlier, that so far we haven't seen issues that are what I would call truly significant in terms of the vetoes that that Republicans have sustained. Having said that, you can almost hear the campaign mailers and radio ads with listing the number of times that Republicans voted for something before they voted against it, echoing the line that was made famous by Senator Kerry in his presidential race. So there's a lot of flip-flopping here. It will have some political consequences, I think, come election season. But for right now, I think it's easy to – they were relatively easy votes for Republicans to show solidarity with the governor, whereas the votes coming up are places where they may find themselves breaking with him.
And probably if you're a true scholar, you can find in any legislative session examples of bipartisanship and examples of extreme partisanship. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I think these vetoes, they're interesting because they go through the process and the governor's office and the administration certainly has a chance to weigh in on every policy issue before it gets to the governor's desk and is voted on. And then the governor chooses to care enough about it at that point to veto it. But I think it kind of speaks to the governor's leadership style and something that I found really refreshing when I worked for him, that he was going to make his own call based on how he saw things. And that's a hard thing to forward into the process through his aides and through his commissioners and things like that. But when it got to his desk, the buck stopped with him, and it makes it kind of messy sometimes. But I like that about his leadership style.
All right. Thank you. I have an email here. This is from Steve in Brunswick. There is a difference between independent and undecided voters. Given that independent voters are such a large block, what do we know about the breakdown of independents as right libertarian leaning versus left progressive leaning versus people who see themselves swinging between Democrat and Republican? Emily, you want to tackle this one?
Yes. Traditionally, political scientists understand that most independents are independent and yet typically vote in line with one party. And for the most part, we find that the larger breakdown in party membership is reflected as well in what you see in the independent electorate. So we might expect that there would be a similar slight leftward lean to our independent ideological spectrum as well.
Interesting. Good question. Thank you, Steve. Now to Dave in Woolwich. Dave, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Great show. I have a couple questions, but my big question is sort of what's the history behind Elliot Cutler really not aligning himself with the Democratic Party? I feel like it never was really, it was never really hashed out sort of what made him an independent candidate, other than the fact that he didn't think he would do well in a Democratic primary, because he seems, all in all, like a Democratic candidate to me. And then also, what role do we think that the polls are going to play really close to the election date? Because I know that there was a lot of talk in the last cycle about the polls really swinging towards Cutler in the last a few days or a few weeks after a lot of people had already placed their absentee ballots. Some of those people may or may not have changed their vote. I know that I kind of changed my mind based on the polls in the last few days of the election last year.
That's right. There was a lot more poll watching, I think, in the last gubernatorial election than there traditionally is. Mike Cuzzi, I'm going to have you tackle the story of Elliot Cutler. Why is he not a Democrat?
Well, look, I think if you asked Elliot that question, he would probably tell you that both of the parties, Democrats and Republicans, have become smaller, more extreme, don't reflect, as we were talking about earlier, the broader politics and demographics of the state, in that he felt that's not where he wanted to be. And I think the caller is probably right. He also probably recognized that he wouldn't prevail in a Democratic primary. So I think Elliot decided that he would run as an independent because he didn't want to really conform to the extremes of either of the parties.
Do you think I'm certain people have suggested to him that in this space between the two elections, he might want to choose a party. Do we know anything about those conversations?
I don't profess to know any of the intimate details, but I think to the caller's point, I think clearly Elliot shares more in common ideologically with some of the values that he's enunciated on the campaign trail with Democrats than he does with Republicans.
Emily Shaw, how about the other part of Dave's question, the role of the polls? In my time as a reporter in Maine, I can't remember an election in which it was palpable how much people were following every poll that came out, especially as the election approached.
It was. It was a really exciting time for people interested in polls because it was so important to people to understand what the strategy should be leading into those final weeks. And I brought into the studio for us to look at a review of what the polls were saying in the final months of the election campaign in 2010. And you see Elliot Cutler's support doubling between mid-October and the election, which is just incredible. You know, he went from polling below 20% to, you know, averaging, you know, his final numbers in the 36.5. So, you know, there was a very clear impact from people shifting at the last moment to the candidate they believed was most viable.
Dan, you were behind the scenes at that point when those polls were shifting all around. What has what you learned in 2010, what does that mean for 2014?
Well, I guess I would write a concession speech this time because I didn't write one in 2010 thinking that we had a 10-point lead and that, you know, Libby and Cutler would both come in about, you know, 28, 30, 30, 32% and we'd win handily. Yeah, it's just the trends are more important than, you know, and you don't know those until the very end. And the Cutler campaign, Ted O'Meara, they did a great job with the end. They had a lot of great energy, vibrant. Their TV ads were excellent. And I think we underestimated the people's willingness to abandon Senator Mitchell to Libby Mitchell to turn to an alternative in Elliot Cutler.
Mike Cussey. But
that does speak to the point. I mean, the dramatic rise in Cutler's poll numbers in the final couple weeks of the campaign really does raise the question about whether Elliott's support is sticky and sustainable in this election cycle or whether it was really just a mile wide and an inch deep in those final weeks of 2010.
Well, thank you all. What an interesting show. We'll have you back as things change and as we find out if Mike Michaud's really a candidate or you guys are all looking at me like, well, of course. Yes.
I think it's bold of him to run. He's got a very safe congressional seat and he's jumping into a race that he's making himself a candidate. And if he does decide to run, I think it would be, you know, service to Maine and his party, certainly, and commend him for it.
All right. Well, Dan DeMeritt, a Republican political consultant, also a former communications director for Governor LePage, Emily Shaw, assistant professor of political science at Thomas College, and Mike Cussey, former campaign aide to a number of people, including the president, Senator John Kerry, and Congressman Tom Allen. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Lindsay Maynard ran the board, and our volunteer, Scott McAuliffe, answered your calls. We also had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcasts by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, if you have got a computer, you might have had a problem with it. Tomorrow, two computer experts on the show answer why and all of your computer questions, be they Mac, PC, tablet, or something else. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.